There Is One by Gutman Locks. Part 5 of 6. 105. Consider. Imagine having the last mango seed in the world in your hand. Somehow it has come to pass that all the mango trees in the world have been destroyed by a plague, and the sole remaining viable mango seed has fallen into your hand. How would you treat it? The least little change could render it worthless. Too much sun, too much water, too much cold. Any number of things could remove this delicious fruit from the world forever. How carefully you would plant it. The exact temperature, the exact chemical makeup of the soil, fertilizer, water, light, even the wind would be taken into consideration to make sure the seed would come into fruition. How crucial it would be to provide every possible care to ensure that the desirable fruit would again be produced. How much more imperative is it that we carefully plant the seeds of tshuva, repentance, the fruit of a long and happy life in this world, plus a glorious place in the world to come, is in your hand, just as that mango seed could be. But if you do not plant the mango seed, but instead throw it away on some garbage heap, there will be no more mangoes. It's not enough to have the seed. It must be planted. To keep the mango seed tucked away in a vault will also do no good. It is the fruit we want, and the seed is but the means to this end. So it is with the seeds of tshuva, repentance. To have the ability to turn from a wasted life, spent running from one heap to another, or locked away in a mansion surrounded by fences and security guards, is not enough. You must also take steps to ensure that these seeds are planted in fertile ground. A new Baal tshuva, a repentant, should surround himself with wise friends. This is fertile ground that will nurture growth, especially in his early days. He must open his heart, his eyes, and ears to the proper teachings. These are like the rain and sunshine. He must curb his wildness and train himself to walk in the ways of his righteous ancestors. But perhaps most importantly of all, he must learn to serve God with joy. For tshuva, repentance, without joy, will soon dry up, and its fruit will turn to crumbled stone. Indeed, each action is both the fruit of the previous action and the seed for the following action. As such, we must consider with great trepidation the results that will follow our next step. No action is isolated. Everything produces a result. We must realize that indeed this is the garden, and we are both its gardeners and its plants, sowing and reaping each day. If we are to have our storerooms filled before the beginning of the winter season, we must start now, for we never know when the frost will come. 106. Consider. An easy way to test your outlook is to write for 2 minutes on one side of a piece of paper everything that you like. Then after 2 minutes, turn it over, and for another 2 minutes, write everything that you do not like. Next, count the number of things that you wrote on each side and compare them. Are there more positive items or more negative items? Was it easier to compile a huge list of negative things than a small list of positive things? You should be able to quickly list more wonderful things than dreadful ones, and if you cannot, you should try to change your appraisal of what is going on. The fact is, in the end, all that was seen to have been bad will be seen to have been for the good. Therefore, to get the most out of life, we should be able to judge even what seems bad in a favorable light. This will lighten the burden of daily living. 107. Consider. How powerful are thoughts? Thoughts are actions in their early, more subtle stages. Even thoughts that never manifest into physical actions and pass relatively unnoticed create tracks. If they are allowed to go free, they will cause additional similar thoughts to be manifested until a trend of thinking develops that becomes more and more entrenched. This process is, in fact, a wonderful ability given to man. As long as the thoughts are positive, this is seen to be a blessing. But when the thoughts, become depressing, it becomes a severe burden. This tendency to form habitual behavior is indeed a gift. It is the workhorse or machine that makes life easier, as long as the habits formed are uplifting. When this is so, the workhorse is plowing along, making straight rows which will produce delicious fruit. But as soon as the thoughts turn to destructive avenues and are not quickly replaced with constructive thinking, destructive actions will follow. Some examples of constructive thoughts leading to constructive actions and habits are, for instance, choosing to eat healthy food. This will lead to eating healthy food, and then to buying healthy food, which will after time sustain itself, thereby making it easier to maintain and support the initial decision. Also, for instance, brushing the teeth twice a day, rising in the morning, exercising each day, these type of things. It's possible to create and sustain only good, health-giving, peaceful habits. Naturally, opposite is also true. For example, one who allows the mind to dwell on lustful thoughts will soon become severely entrenched in sin. The day will be spent primarily seeking to satisfy those cravings, which will become the primary motivating factor in that person's life. Hate, power, and greed are several more examples of the many degrading possibilities in life which must be stopped in their early stages. The mind must not be allowed to dwell on evil. The way to prevent this is not by fighting with the mind, as this merely exaggerates the problem, but by simply replacing the undesirable thoughts with pleasant ones. The mind is a giant that can be easily tamed with simple, lovely thinking. 108. Consider. Simon never believed that the Messiah would come during his lifetime. His brother Levi believed with all his heart that the Messiah would certainly come during his lifetime. Both brothers have died now. Simon appeared to have been right. Levi had a better life. 109. Consider. Normally, forgetting seems to be somewhere between a nuisance and a curse. When useful information is forgotten, especially those important lessons in life that prevent injury, we experience forgetting as a curse. But as with all things in creation, it can also be a blessing. When a horrible tragedy befalls a person or a nation, and the mind is shocked and dazed, life stands still, bearings are lost, and even tears will not flow to wash away the piercing thoughts. In such a state, the person does not eat or drink. Sleep does not come. There's no escaping the screaming mind that bellows over and over, "My loved one is gone. I am alone. There's no way to change this." Without the kindness of forgetting, such a life could not go on. Death would become the only hope. But God has made it so we do go on even after such an event. The memory clouds and softens the pain. Some sweet recollections sweep in and tears sweep away the scene we cannot bear to remember. Time provides the bandage and nature takes its course. Later, we go on adding this experience to our being. We hobble for a while and then we walk all right. This indeed can be a wonderful thing, to be able to forget. 110. Consider. Aliyah means going up. When a Jewish man is honored by being called up to the reading of the Torah, he is having an Aliyah. His soul is also being honored, and it is having an Aliyah too. When a Jewish person goes to settle in the land of Israel, this is also called an Aliyah, as he is going up to live in the Holy Land. The Torah always refers to traveling to Israel as going up. This is due to the special holiness with which the land is imbued. It is not merely an allegory or a metaphoric saying, but an actual spiritual and physical reality. Here is one of those rare opportunities where man can experience a predictable spiritual occurrence, a holiness expressed in the physical that requires neither faith nor intention. By simply living in the land of Israel, a Jew is strengthened. This comes about because the Jew is obeying the divine plan and allowing himself to receive the inheritance that God has given him. Even when a Jew visits Israel, he will be able to recognize his spiritual ascent. However, since the spiritual awareness increases ever so subtly each day, many do not even realize that it is happening until they leave. Then, there's almost universal agreement as to what occurs. Usually, upon descending the airport ramp in one's country of origin, there's a strong feeling of sinking a notch or two. Most people shrug it off and say, someday I will return, but the truth is that they are already forgetting. And the longer they stay away, the more they will forget, until the elevation that they experience while in Israel will become little more than the other sites listed in the travel brochure. Can it be that we live in an age where spiritual ascent is readily available and the majority of Jews opt for castles and fleets instead? What of that can we take with us when we leave? And how much do we really even gain from it while we are here? To increase our spiritual allotment increases the quality of our life both in this world and in the world to come. Everything improves when our souls improve. Life takes on a better air, the senses perceive life more clearly, and we're able to enjoy the moment with more satisfaction. Then, as the time comes to exit from this world, we do so without regret, and we move on to an even more glorious portion than we would have had we ignored the spiritual possibilities in this world. 111. Consider, why is the Jewish man bound with so many commandments, while the Jewish woman seems to have so few? The woman is considered to be in a more revealed state, more open and sensitive, while man must do something to uncover his heart. She can live a more spiritual life naturally. Her tendency is to be sensitive and loving, which is the foundation that man must glean from observance of the many commandments. Man, by his nature, is generally aggressive and competitive, while a woman is more ready to accept a simple peace. While he must continually engage himself in the pursuit of peace, she generally can find spiritual satisfaction with much less searching. This is not to imply that her religious duties are unimportant. On the contrary, she has been entrusted with transmitting the spirit of Judaism, while man has traditionally preserved its letters and its laws. A man without a wife is accused of spilling blood each day. His wife is the presence of God who helps man to realize his potential. Her duties include providing a kosher home and overseeing the children's education. Judaism is a home-centered religion as opposed to a synagogue-centered, and the woman is the joy and foundation of the home. Although she enriches and is enriched by the commandments entrusted to her, her greatest spiritual reward comes when giving birth and witnessing the life that she has helped to create. Motherhood is not a commandment to the woman, but if she should choose motherhood, her time spent therein is considered of such importance that it supersedes all time-bound commandments. Meanwhile, man must find his spiritual satisfaction through the fulfillment of God's commandments. The constant fencing in and leading forward provided by the Torah is to bring the man to his spiritual awareness that the woman inherited while she was still in the womb. This is why the roles of men and women must not be exchanged. For a woman to forsake her natural God-given role in order to take upon herself a lifelong study of the Talmud would rob her of her birthright. Not that study is forbidden to her, but that she would be squeezed into a role the fruit of which could not possibly satisfy the natural feelings within her. A woman choosing the traditional role of a Talmudic student at the expense of her natural role would find herself in a similar position to a Jewish man who tries to find his salvation in one of the many religions of the world, even though there could very well be truth and ethical teachings there. Because the Jew has been created a Jew, his salvation must come from the Torah. Any other gain will produce a lesser result, and in the end will, in fact, be detrimental. 112. Consider. Early morning Shabbos service in the Sephardi synagogue. The men begin to gather about an hour before sunrise. The walk to the synagogue is cool and dark. It's the most gentle time of the day. Not even the birds are up to disturb the stillness. The velvet feeling lasts until we enter the well-lighted room. It's furnished with benches and chairs lined up encircling a raised, railed platform. The walls boast large posters depicting various Kabbalistic designs and prayers. The feeling seems to be somewhere between Byzantine, Turkey, and Persia. It is different, but still comfortable. Soon the importance of prayer takes over, and we become lost in thoughts about God and His kindness to us. Next, the singing, as we slowly pronounce each word. It begins to elevate, and a slight rocking motion draws upon the holiness as we digest the familiar prayers. The minyan grows, and on this day it is especially large, as one of the men has a son who will soon be married, and he and his friends have gathered to give honor and blessings to the family. In the next room, separated by a curtain, is a small gathering of elderly women, the groom's mother and her friends. They are colorfully dressed, especially their headscarves. They sit patiently and reverently awaiting the reading of the Torah. Emotions seem to surface quickly as I look at these women with soft faces and motherly wrinkles. They have worked their entire lives for their families and have asked for nothing in return. It is strange how sometimes it's easier to see such good qualities in other people's mothers than in our own. The pace quickens as the sunrise approaches. We cover our faces with our prayer shawls and attest to God's oneness. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. The prayers become louder and more distinct as we prepare for the standing, silent prayers. Then, as the sun begins to shine into the morning, we all stand, face the holy temple, and silently say the prescribed blessings. Next, it's time for the reading of the Torah. I notice a small group of children have gathered. The Torah reading progresses normally. Then the bridegroom is called up. As he approaches the Torah, the women, who before were absolutely silent, begin to trill like birds. Their tongues reverberate, producing a sound like a flock of frenzied birds welcoming a long-lost friend. Then they begin to throw candies at the bridegroom. Smiles pop out and small children fling themselves to the floor, scrambling for the brightly wrapped sweets. Again and again, the shrill, high-pitched warble fills the room as another shower of sugar bombards the room. Although it's especially aimed at the bridegroom, many salvos are purposely scattered around the room, making even the most stubborn smile. The room is filled with sweetness as old men remember and young men dream. Next, the groom's family is called up. Another shower, another chorus of excited calls. And the children dive after the small pieces of treasure. The gabbai goes from man to man with a serving tray, delivering small, colorfully wrapped packages of candy for the adults, who are no match for the speedy scavengers who have already swept the floor clean. After the morning prayers, we move outside under the olive tree for kiddush. The Rav sanctifies the day, and everyone tastes the wine. Then each man makes blessings over the various types of foods, and the Rav begins his discourse. The groom sits on his right and receives many pats and prayers and good wishes. The women sit off to the side and listen intently to the words of wisdom. A very old woman is escorted in, and the other women stand. One elderly woman reaches forward and kisses her hand. How warm this seems to me. The sunlight plays on the tables and the birds contribute their songs. How simple holiness is. How easy and pleasant are your ways. 113. Consider Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of the month of Av. This is the anniversary of the destruction of the temples in Yerushalayim and of the exile of the Jewish people. Without doubt, it's the saddest day of the year. We mourn the destruction of our people and of our land. Ghastly atrocities came against us. We were all but destroyed by their ferocity. Yet, we see in the lessons of Tisha B'Av that our enemies are but feathers in his hand, and it is we who bring on these disasters by turning from his way and fighting among ourselves. Why do Arabs throw stones at Jews? Do we do something to bring this upon ourselves, or are we merely innocent victims? Recently in Israel, Jews argued with such intensity that some began to throw stones and bottles at each other. Holy synagogues were set on fire and Jews fought in the street with great intensity. Religious Jews banded together to try to prevent the desecration of the Shabbos and what the newspapers called the Sabbath Wars. Jewish police charged on horseback, swinging clubs, bloodying gray-bearded men whose only crime was to be standing on the sidewalk yelling, "Shabbos! Shabbos!" It was a ghastly mess. What stopped these riots? All of a sudden, thousands of Arabs began throwing stones and bottles at Jews. The Jews had to stop to foil this common enemy. The story of Tisha B'Av is not that we have enemies. We know that we have enemies. But Tisha B'Av teaches us that we are defeated only when we fight among ourselves. When we cease fighting amongst ourselves, we bring peace to ourselves and to the world. Loving each other removes our enemies and fills our houses with joy. But Tisha B'Av is much more than mourning. It is also the birthday of the Mashiach. Out of the depths of sorrow, from the deepest pit, we turn upward toward hope. As our prayers are answered and the redemption is born, we look again towards life, life that will free all mankind from the evils of destruction. What has come we have brought upon ourselves, and what will come we will bring upon ourselves. Soon this sad day will become a major holiday of joy. We will feast and drink and dance and sing. Joy unlimited will flow from our cities and fields. We will sing, "Thou hast turned our mourning into dancing." Sorrow, even its remembrance, will be gone forever. It will be a new life, a life of revealed holiness. We will look back curiously at the strange time when we actually mourned on such a festive day. The immense crowd at the Kotel sitting on the ground resembles campers coming around the campfire listening to stories of a long time ago. History must be remembered and mourned, but as we anticipate the imminent redemption, the day seems to be taking on an almost festive nature. We are so close now, one more step. For such a long time we were exiled from the Holy Land. Now, after 2,000 years, we have returned. First the shore, Tel Aviv, then the approach to Yerushalayim itself. Now, at last, we can actually pray at the Kotel. We have come this far and need only one last step, the one mitzvah that will put us over the Kotel onto the Temple Mount itself. We feel as if at any second someone will do the smallest mitzvah that will start the shofar blowing, and we will see our holy temple come down from above and fill the void its passing created. Knowing it is so close, feeling in our souls that it is imminent, Tisha B'Av cannot be as sorrowful as before. The bride is getting dressed, the meal is being prepared, the groom is stretching forth his arms towards his fulfillment, and the angels on high are gathering to witness the supernal joy that God will allow us as he laughs and sings at the happy completion of his creation, the crown of time, the fruit of earth, peace. 114. Consider Rosh Chodesh Elul, the new moon of the month of Elul. Each moment has its purpose and its taste. The purpose of Elul is to prepare for the coming month of Tishrei. Tishrei brings Rosh Hashanah, the new year, the time to come before the king with our hopes and petitions. To come to the palace before an earthly king is no light matter, how much more so for the king of kings. Preparations must be made well in advance. We have to search ourselves diligently to know what must be done in order to secure a favorable decree. These preparations are done in Elul. Additional prayers are chanted before the regular morning prayers. Getting up 1 hour early produces a change of attitude, an excitement of something important enough to rouse the entire community from sleep. The shofar is blown each morning, anticipating the forthcoming audience with the king. When the final redemption comes, it will be the sound of the shofar that will call the dead to life. In Elul, our souls feel this arousal and awaken more each day as Rosh Hashanah approaches. The awe increases and the excitement grows as we tackle the long list of things to be done. Are we doing anything that we know is wrong? Is there anything outstanding that might cloud our petition or, God forbid, evoke wrath instead of the grace we are seeking? We must settle all outstanding debts, spiritual as well as physical. Did we fail to keep a promise? Is there someone we have offended? Are we at peace with ourselves and the community? Important questions such as these must be asked all year long, but especially now in the month of Elul. This is also the time to check our mezuzahs and tefillin to see if they are still valid. New clothes are bought now so we may appear pleasing before the king. Garments represent deeds, so we don new deeds to show that we are renewed and intend to improve ourselves in the coming year. During this month, God is accessible as at no other time. All year long, God, the king, is enthroned in his palace. In Elul, the king is in the field, actually seeking out his subjects, listening to their petitions. He moves about freely and is immediately accessible to every subject in his domain. The peasant farmer with hoe in hand is given the opportunity to speak face to face with the ruler of all. Wake up, Yidden, from your dreams in exile. The old man moves from window to window, knocking with his mallet against the wooden shutters. He calls out, Shlichus, Shlichus, awakening the community well before dawn. His steps shuffle from side to side as he bumps along the narrow street. Waken! Waken! The street, moments before an empty and lonely cavern, slowly begins to fill as the sleepy pious begin to trickle to the mikveh and then off to the minyan. Century upon century, we have repeated this sequence long enough for dripping water to crush stone. Yet today our ancient traditions are falling upon deaf ears and are not touching the hearts of the majority of Jews. The preparations come and go. The audience with the king comes and goes. The years go by while the few patiently stand guard, waiting for the majority to waken. If only we knew what we have in our hands, what we have the ability to accomplish. Peace, the dream of every man, is within reach. If only we would reach. 115. Consider. Thoughts. A thought may appear as a picture, somewhat like a movie projected on a screen. Its composite produces a single image which reflects a certain group of ideas or feelings. It seems to be a reality made up of the items that are being depicted. For instance, a thought of a table and chair appears to be made of wood, but it is not. It is made of ideas. Ideas exist in reality as ideas, but not as wood. Although their existence has as much validity as does the existence of the wooden table, ideas lack the density of the wooden table. In studying the nature of thought, it can easily be seen that the images of tables are mere relationships without wooden roots. We can grab onto a wooden table with our hands, while an idea table would slip right through our fingers. Although the densities are different, the wooden world is actually made of the same energy as the world of ideas. As discussed above, the table is wood, molecules, atoms, light, place, which is the same spectrum that the idea world is in, but the wood appears on the more constricted end. This type of investigation shows that although our daily world seems to be within the confines of fixed borders, depending upon the perspective, it is just like the realm of ideas. It is made of will. Just as the mind can disperse an idea, so can the entire physical creation be dispersed by changing the will that sustains it. All that we know and experience is being created and sustained by the supernal will. When the objective of this will is fulfilled, when creation completes its purpose, then just as the mind disperses a thought, so will the entire creation be dispersed and revert to its pre-manifested state. This should not, God forbid, be considered to be a loss or a dreaded destruction of life. Rather, it will be as a successful departure from a cramped cocoon, with the spreading of glorious wings of light to soar into the sparkling heights of heaven. 116. Consider. Imagine a certain species of butterfly that makes an extremely large migratory cycle over thousands of miles. The journey would take longer than any single butterfly could live. Each would experience only a small portion of the journey without having realized that there is in fact a complete cycle. People who live and die without realizing that their deeds produce similar deeds can be likened to such a butterfly. As it says, those who are born are destined to die. Those who are dead are destined to live again. To not realize the consequences of actions, like for like, is to believe life begins with birth and ends with death, with nothing before and nothing after. Life does not begin with birth. Birth begins because of life, one portion across from the other. This shows that life precedes birth, living in the father's sperm, the mother's egg, and the soul above. The coming together of the ingredients to form a child simply continue this life in the womb. Similarly, seeding action precedes all action. Just as these ingredients become the child, so do thoughts become the deed. Just as parents' genes shape the child, so does the nature of thought shape the deed. We're able to see a certain order in daily life. Good brings good and evil evil. We must assume that which set the world into motion did so by willing thoughts similar to the resulting creation. Since we live in these bodies for such a short span and see only a small portion of creation, much of our reward and, God forbid, punishment will be manifested in the world to come. At death, there are accounts to be settled, waves to be dissipated by additional living until all accounts are paid. Both debits and credits must be settled. Such is the journey of the soul. Although the individual may not be aware of his previous existence or continuing existence, it is just like the journey of the group of butterflies. Each butterfly drops off in its place as each body drops off of the soul. Just as the group of butterflies continues until its journey is complete, so will the soul continue traveling until its final redemption. Then the overall cycle will be completed, as all will be realized to be all. The souls will drop the individual distinctions, and all life will realize it is one. As it says, for they will all know me. 117. Consider. The old man walked slowly home from evening prayers. It was dark and he was rather tired. Somewhat stooped, he made his way, looking down as his mind reviewed the list of things that he had to do. He noticed a stone lying in his path that in the dark could cause someone to stumble. For an instant, he felt too tired to kick it out of the way, but he quickly remembered that as he would reach out to help his fellow man, so would God have his fellow man reach out to help him. This for this. He slid the stone aside to where it no longer posed a danger and looked up to continue on his way. He was surprised to see that he had already reached home and was, in fact, standing in front of his own doorway. He smiled as he realized that in the early hours of the morning, when he would come out for morning prayers, he would have tripped on that stone. Here, he thought, is a case of God using me to help me. 118. Consider, why do we light candles to remember the dead? We say prayers for them. We give charity in their names. We're accustomed to naming our children after those who have passed away. But why light a candle? What connection do we see between a flame and their souls? The soul in the body is somewhat like the flame on a wick. The fire consumes the wax or oil of the candle without itself being used up. The body, not the soul, is consumed by life. Even if there are many flames, there will only be a single light in the room. Although there are many souls in the room, there is only one life present. The candle has form, or the flame, the light, has no form of its own. The body has form, while the soul is formless. The formless flame is directed and moved about by the wind. Wind in Hebrew is the same word as spirit, ruach, which directs and moves the soul about. The size of the flame is not determined by the size of the candle. The size of the soul is not determined by the size of the body. A small-bodied person does not necessarily have a small soul. Although the candle has many characteristics or possible uses, such as sealing and lubricating, its primary purpose is to give light. The same is true for the body. Although it has many functions, its essential task is to house the soul in order to bring light into the world. No matter what color or shape the candle is, the flame's color does not change. No matter what color or shape the body is, the color of the soul is unaffected. The hotter portion of the flame is the upper portion. The soul is the higher aspect of man. One can light many thousands of candles from a single candle without losing the slightest amount of original light. In fact, surrounded by other lit candles, it stands in even more light. The soul can also ignite many other souls, making them aware of life's purpose, and then it becomes even more illuminated because it was instrumental in spreading light. It is easier to relight a wick than it was to light it in the first place. The soul that once knew but went astray, one which has forgotten, is easier to relight, to remind, and to bring back than is one who has never been aware. The flame always goes up, reaching toward heaven. The soul always strives to go up to remember its true identity. The flame goes up and the soul exits up. In the end, after the flame has consumed all of the candle, it itself must go. So it is with the soul. After its desires have raced the body through 70 or 80 years, the body is consumed, and then the soul must also go out. 119. Consider, the young Israeli had a dream, and it bothered him that he did not understand its meaning. He dreamed that he was washing the kotel, and the water splashed on to some candles and put them out. He was not religious and did not know whom to ask, but he figured since the dream was about the kotel, maybe his answer would be there. He traveled to the kotel and looked for someone that might be able to help. He saw an old man with a long white beard, and although embarrassed, he pushed himself to ask. "Excuse me, sir," he began. "I had a dream, and it bothers me that I don't understand its meaning. Could you tell me what it means?" The old man was taken aback. It's not every day that someone asks to have a dream interpreted. He thought of Yaakov's son Yosef being asked by Pharaoh to explain what his dream meant, and he answered the young man in a similar manner. Hashem gives answers. Seeing the young man was upset, he asked him to tell him about the dream. "I dreamed that I was washing the kotel, and the water splashed onto some candles and put them out." The old man asked, "Is everyone all right in your family?" The youth nodded. "Did anyone pass away recently?" the old man continued. "Yes, my father, just a couple months ago." The old man continued gently, "Do you know that it's a custom of our people to keep a candle burning for a departed soul for the first year? and then on certain holidays, and on the anniversary from then on? The youth shook his head. No. This is what your dream was telling you. You felt that your prayers were so pleasing to your father that they were washing the coattail. But because you were following your own way instead of the tradition of our fathers, you were actually putting out the light of remembrance. The young man thanked the old man and assured him that from then on he would do it the traditional way. The old man looked up and humbly thanked God for having put the truth before him. 120. Consider. Yankel and Sara were married for over 10 years, yet they had no children. What made matters worse, Sara's father was one of the best fertility doctors in America. Each month would go by like a knife stabbing his heart. His wife dreaded having to tell him again that there was no hope for this month either. He became so bitter, it affected his very being. Finally, the rabbi yelled at him. If he didn't accept things as what had to be and stop this dreadful bitterness, there could be no room for Hashem's blessings to come in. But the desire was so ingrained, he could not help himself. He dragged through life. The Rebbe is accustomed to handing out wine for a cup of blessings to his Hasidim after certain forbringings. The men line up and file past the Rebbe one by one. Each gently takes his tiny cup of blessings, knowing that it is filled not just with wine, but with all that his heart desires. One night the Rebbe forbringed later than usual, so it was especially late by the time Yankel moved in front of him. To his great surprise, instead of giving him a cup of wine, the Rebbe handed him a bottle of vodka. He told him to take the bottle and to have a forbringing with two other men who also could not have children. Of course, he did exactly as the Rebbe ordered. The next night, he rounded up two friends who, like himself, had not been able to have children for many years. They drank the bottle of vodka, told Hasidic stories, sang songs about mysteries they did not even understand, and went home wondering if the Rebbe had given them some kind of consolation prize, or dare they think that perhaps it was something more. It did not take long to find out. Within 1 year, each of the three men fathered a healthy, beautiful son. 121. Consider the rumblings of the Mashiach. Much like the birth pangs that announce the imminent arrival of a newborn baby, there will be rumblings to announce the arrival of the Mashiach. A baby is not born without warning, and neither will the Mashiach come without notice. Herein lies the evidence that we are living in the age that will see his arrival. For 2,000 years it was silent. The land of Israel was desolate. Jews were scattered throughout the world, hoping for redemption. But there was no encouragement. The decades turned into centuries, and still all was silent. There was not even a hint of the possibility of redemption. Jews believed by sheer tenacity, but there was never a sign that we could come home. The centuries turned into millenniums, and still there was no hope, not the slightest ripple. Then in 1917 of this current era, the governing body of Israel, which was then called Palestine, announced that they would look favorably upon a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Although we could come home, for the most part we all refused and preferred to assimilate into the various host countries to which we were scattered. Come home, the king called. We're too busy with such good lives, so many of us replied. We rebelled again after such a long wait, and his fury was unleashed. The Holocaust followed. Then the survivors tried to flock home, but by then it was not so easy. At last we made it to the edge of our homeland and a few tiny footholds within. Next, we made it to the wall of our beloved city, Yerushalayim. Then at last we were blessed to see the actual Temple Mount with its holy kotel fall into our hands. After 2,000 years, we could again freely pray next to our holiest site. Now we are home again, after 2,000 years of silence. The tears of joy stream down our faces, but still there is one more step to go. One more step and our heart will be returned. The temple will stand again and we will all live in peace. This is where we are today. All this has happened in just a few years. For 2,000 years, silence. Then in our very lifetime, rumbling and movement and victories beyond any wildest imaginings. All this is common these days with design, intention, and reason. Time will not swallow up these changes without fulfilling their purpose. The silence has already been completed. The rumblings have rumbled. Now we are ready for the third temple, and it will be soon and within our day. 122. Consider. For a chair to stand firmly, it needs at least three legs. Although it's possible to sit on a two- or even one-legged chair, this can be done only with great attention and care for a brief period and not very comfortably. A person's daily life may be viewed as a chair we rest upon. In order to have a long, relaxed, and comfortable life, we must have at least three legs firmly on the ground. First, one leg must provide a firm spiritual base. Man without a spiritual purpose will soon corrupt. His drive in life will be for immediate satisfaction without concern for the future. Next, man must have a peaceful family life. As it says, it's not good for man to be alone. A man with a family lives longer. His day is regulated and his goals and priorities must be in order. It's the family that sustains the world and assures a future. Finally, a man must make a continuing contribution to his fellow man. Whether this contribution is in the form of visiting the sick or making shoes, being a president or selling insurance, each person must take his place as a functioning participant in the world. We are given the opportunity to live in this world, and we must not be satisfied to take without giving. When a person satisfies these three areas, his life will stand firmly without the constant pressure to balance himself, and life will be joyful and easy. 123. Consider, why are we commanded to eat matzah on Passover? Why is it called the bread of humility? And what connection can eating a certain shaped bread possibly have to do with being set free? For the entire week of Passover, we are forbidden to have leavening in our homes. Why? What is the nature of leaven that makes it forbidden not only to eat, but even to be seen in our possession? All of these questions can become answered easily when we examine the nature of leaven. Leaven is a substance that, when added to water and flour, will cause the mixture to rise. This swelling or puffiness allows the bread to take on an elevated shape. In order to submit ourselves to the rule of Hashem, we must be humble and not filled with puffy pride. A proud person fills his chest with air and raises himself up, while a humble person considers himself to be lowly. As leaven puffs up a loaf of bread, so does pride swell up our egos. A proud person says, "I am all," while a humble person says, "God is all." To be set free, we must follow the many dictates of Hashem and not stand up and say, "I am setting myself free." For the hundreds of years that we were enslaved in Egypt, not a single slave successfully escaped. Such was the thickness of that slavery. Now, too, we must realize that the grip of limitation is so strong that there is no other way for a Jew to escape but to follow the intricacies of the Torah and to flatten his bread. Each of us needs to be aware of our own physical limitations as individual beings. But we must not believe that these limitations exist from all perspectives. To be set free, one must gain an unlimited perspective. To do this, we must search even the tiniest corners with a lighted candle and a feather, as we do when we check for leaven the night before Passover until we can honestly say we have ridden ourselves of leaven. We are but dust, but flour, and we are ready to follow the order handed down so that we may experience both the physical and spiritual freedom promised to us by God and exemplified in the order of the Passover service. 124. Consider. Peace versus peace. P-I-E-C-E versus P-E-A-C-E. A pie can have many pieces. Well, peace can have only one. 125. Consider. The cure for speaking evil is speaking good. 126. Consider. Why have the rabbis placed a fence around the Torah? When the Torah prohibits something, is this not enough? Why must the rabbis come and place an additional restriction around an already restricted act? For instance, the Torah prohibits work on Shabbos, while the rabbis forbid even the handling of tools on Shabbos. Not handling tools on Shabbos is considered to be an offense guarding the prohibition of work. In Israel today, on the border between Israel and Syria, there was a severe problem with infiltrators sneaking past the border guards bent on murdering innocent Jews. To overcome this insidious threat, the Israeli army erected an extremely high-voltage electrical fence along the border. If anyone would even brush against this fence, they would be instantly killed. The fence did its job. It worked fine, and the infiltration all but ceased. However, a new danger was created. When the children playing ball, or soldiers walking along on patrol, or a farmer or tourist would stumble, the electrical fence would take their life as well. In order to remove this extreme danger, the army erected a strong, sharp, barbed wire fence some 20 feet inside, blocking the approach to the electrical fence. Now, if anyone inside Israel would stumble towards the electrical fence, instead of being allowed to go all the way to actually touch the life-taking fence, they would be stopped short. Certainly they would be upset by their cuts and even angry at the army for having erected this second and, in their minds, needless fence, but their lives would have been saved, and they should indeed be thankful for the fence that merely cut them. So it is with the fence constructed by the rabbis around the Torah. By prohibiting, for example, even the handling of tools on Shabbos, which the Torah itself allows, the rabbis have created a protective fence around the Torah prohibition of working on Shabbos. If a man cannot even pick up a tool, he will not end up working with it. If he does handle the tool, he will become entangled in the sharp barbed wire rabbinical fence. He may cut himself, he may become embroiled in the argument, but he will not fall against the even more serious Torah prohibition. 127. Consider. What is the power of the East and what is its attraction? Do the people who practice it really perform miracles? Deep in South India, there is a guru who has more than 8 million devotees. Now, perhaps 60 million. Many of these devotees gather at his ashram for festivals and to request favors such as blessings for healings or wealth. What is the special attraction of this particular guru that entices so many people to make this so-called spiritual pilgrimage? While there, the devotees witness the guru materializing diamonds, books, candies, virtually anything the devotee desires. He then gives these gifts to whom he wishes. For a devotee to receive such a gift is considered to be a great blessing, far beyond its material value. Can he really do this, or is it mere trickery? Another guru outside of Bombay regularly demonstrates the power to so-called zap his devotees with great bolts of energy, even from afar. The devotees consider this a great blessing that reinforces their belief in the guru and his teachings. Other gurus throughout India demonstrate various strange and apparently unnatural powers. Are these all tricks or hypnotism? These definitely do occur. Not only are they really happening, but this power comes through the hand of Abraham, our father, as explained in the Torah. The Torah tells us that Abraham had many children. To Yitzchak, to Isaac, he gave everything he had, but to the other sons, he gave them gifts and sent them on to the east country. These gifts are defined by our sages as the names of unclean powers. One of these descendants of Abraham is named Asherim, which is defined as a camp. Today, when one seeks out a man with such mystical powers in the East, he goes to his ashram, and there he finds today's descendant of Ashrim. The man with this power will profess some connection with Brahmanism, which is named after Abraham. One of the three godheads, so-called godheads, in this religion is Shiva, which is the name of one of Abraham's grandchildren whom he sent to the East. One of the major examples of a so-called God incarnate is a man called Ram. Ram, in Hebrew, means exalt or raise. One of the mystical names of God revealed in the Torah is Aleph Vav Mem, pronounced Om. The central and most often used chant of the Brahmin religion is Om. Abram is called the Hebrew, which means from the other side of the river. Hindu, the name of the people of India, is also translated as coming from beyond or across the river, albeit certainly a different river. Indian history teaches that a fair-skinned people came from beyond the Indus River and brought the religion that they mixed in with their present-day religion, which is still practiced there today. When a Jew travels to India to seek out the knowledge of this power and even acquires it, he has spiritually ceased being Yitzchak, the son of Abraham, and his wife Sarah, and rather he becomes Asherim, the son of Abraham, and his concubine. In effect, he gives up the inheritance of everything he had he gave on to Yitzchak, and instead inherits, but unto the sons of the concubine that Abraham had, he gave them gifts and sent them away onto the east country. What initially attracts the eye often loses its attraction. As a person receives a diamond or a power from a guru, he feels blessed. As time goes on, he will realize that the guru has replaced God with the guru's form, and the practice of truth and ethical behavior with the guru's private brand of spirituality. Even when the truth is known, it is not always so easy to free oneself from the grip of a spiritually unclean practice. A particularly powerful guru near Bombay taught hundreds of thousands of devotees, mostly Americans and many of them Jews, the secret of what he called the highest vision possible. He wrote a popular book revealing what he called the deepest truth. The name of the book was The Blue Pearl. In this book, he described in detail the methods of attaining this vision. Many devotees took his teaching to heart and went off for years of deprivation, meditating in caves or cemeteries, anywhere they could be alone. Year after year, they forced themselves to seek this vision that finally did come to a few, the blue light. It's an exquisite vision that flashes before the mind's eye, rendering the meditator flabbergasted, all but unconscious. Upon seeing it, the meditator feels greatly rewarded. It surpasses any beauty imaginable, but also it then produces a heaviness that begins to weigh against the mind and eyelids. The most so-called successful seekers found this blue hue glowing before their eyes even when they were not meditating. They walked around as if departed from the world. They were considered to have attained so-called great heights, but it did not help them. Were they happy? No. They were dazed, and after some time, they became extremely concerned about this heavy light. It was beautiful, but then it began to hurt. Their eyesight blurred as this so-called beauty would sweep across their vision. But they were helpless. There was no chapter in the Blue Pearl on turning this light off. What does the Torah say about this vision? If only these young people would have read the Torah or the Zohar or the Tanya instead of the Blue Pearl. These books explain that the blue light is actually the lowest light, not the highest. The Torah says the blue light is under his feet. For proof of this, the Zohar Chadash points to the flame of a candle. The blue is always on the bottom. The white light, the clear glow which surrounds the upper portion of the flame, is the high light, not the blue light. The Zohar warns, all colors seen in dreams and visions are a good omen except blue, which denotes judgment and has the power to snatch away souls. It goes on to say much ardent prayer is needed to avert this from happening. The Tanya describes the pristine whiteness which comes before coloration. Now the magnitude of this error can be seen. It's no small thing to give a seeker such inaccurate advice. It is much more difficult to get rid of such an unclean power than it is to acquire it. Still, we are given choice, spiritually and physically. What we want will come. So the question must be, is this really what I want? Look carefully and try to anticipate the consequences. Look for advice in trustworthy places. If there's a watchman swinging a lantern in the darkest night, you certainly will take heed. Whatever your decisions, do not go after gods that your fathers feared not.
Thereisone.com